Rep. Tenney entered the room, we're going to start our meeting. Welcome, Rep. Tenney. That's perfect timing. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to JAFCO. My name is Mike Alhieb, and I am chair of the Broward delegation. We have some members who are running a little bit behind and some members who are here today. So what we're going to do is start our meetings. I'm going to ask you to please silence your cell phones while the meeting is in progress. Microphones up here are live and the microphone at the podium is live. This meeting is being recorded. With the exception of our constitutional officers, and I believe we have two today, we are allowing each presenter, and I think we have close to 20 presenters today, each presenter approximately 2 minutes. I'll do my best if you're closing, so you allow you to finish closing, but otherwise we are going to cut you off at 2 minutes. If you need to use a restroom, the restrooms are located out that door through the main lobby. Masks should remain on and over your nose while you're in the building, except while you're addressing us at the podium if you want to take it off. And with that, we are going to start our meeting today, and I would like to thank Cindy and Andrea for setting this up for us. They are the power behind the delegation. They sit behind me, and always we try to thank them at the beginning and the end of the meeting. They really do an amazing job, and they did so this time in picking such a beautiful facility, a facility that is close to this delegation's heart. Many of us work very hard to get appropriations and fund JAFCO, and if you don't know JAFCO, it truly is an amazing, amazing program. I always say that when I come and I tour JAFCO, it's a program that breaks and heals my heart both at the same time. And with that being said, I'd like to thank JAFCO for hosting us today. You do have an amazing, wonderful facility, and I know that you all have some comments that you'd like to make as well. Correct?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that on my schedule? Okay. Yes, it is. And with that, I'll ask everyone to please rise as we do the Pledge of Allegiance. And the flag is going to be behind us, and behind us, okay. And I'll ask our attorney, Mr. Einstein, to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do I need a roll call? Okay. Ms. Knowles, if you would please take the roll.
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Senator Polsky.
Senator
Cook.
Senator
Erskine.
Senator Farmer.
Here.
Senator Jones.
Representative Lamarca.
Representative Rose. Representative Onfroy. Representative Hunchak.
Representative Daly.
Representative
Jenny.
Here.
Representative Gillard, Representative Woodson, Representative Robinson, Representative Fabrizio, Representative Bartleman,
Representative Ferrero,
Vice Chair Williams.
Here.
Chair.
Present.
Chair, before we could go, could I have 30 seconds? Personal privilege.
Personal privilege, of course.
Thank you. I want to thank you, Chair, and the members at our last delegation meeting. You all held a moment of silence for my mom, Joanne Farmer, who passed away in September. I had just left because I had to take my dad to a doctor's appointment, but I just want to thank you for doing that. She was a truly special lady, and she very much valued public service and encouraged me to run for office and to fight for the things I fight for. And so your kind gesture was very, very much appreciated. You and Representative Williams, Vice Chair Williams, made that gesture, and I can't thank you both enough. Very kind, very thoughtful, and my family, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Well, it was our pleasure to acknowledge your mom's passing in the way that we did, and again, you know, we offer our sincere condolences. And with that, is Ms. Franco present?
Sam.
There you are. Hi, Sarah. Sarah Franco is the CEO of JAFCO, and again, we thank you for allowing us to use your facility today.
My pleasure. Thank you and welcome to the delegation. I just wanted to take a minute to, first of all, just to thank you because I've been the CEO here for 29 years and 20 years ago, we approached the delegation to ask for seed funding for our Jaffco Children's Village, which is a few miles down the road from here. It was Senator Rich at the time and Representative Bogdanoff who sponsored that for us, and it resulted in $1 million in seed funding. We raised $7 million to match it to build the facility, and it's currently a $6 million a year operation that we fund mostly with private donations, so we really appreciate that. And then about 10 years ago, we approached you again to help us build this facility. And once again, that was funded at another $1 million, and we really appreciate that. And this was a $14 million project that we raised from the private sector to match your $1 million. And currently, Representative Gottlieb and Senator Polsky, we really appreciate the appropriation that we had last year of $850,000, and the year before it was $500,000 to allow for scholarships for parents raising children with developmental disabilities to be able to come here and use this space and take a breather, get their children the services that they need. And this coming year, again, we thank you for sponsoring that bill. And in addition, Jaffco's third site is the Eagles Haven site, which is a recovery center for the shooting victims of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting. And there we have an appropriation bill. That funding is coming to an end from the federal government, but now the trial is just starting, so our work is really just starting, and I wanted to thank Representative Pinchowski. I call her Christine, and also Senator Polsky for sponsoring that bill, and we just appreciate, we know that we have your support in Tallahassee. Our lobbyist is Senator Bogdanoff. She works for us pro bono. She's a former board member of ours and foster mother for a foster care program. So now that more of the delegation is here, I think it would be lovely if, since we're in this building that you created, and also so much of Jaffco was really a result of the hard work of your delegation, that if I could ask for 10 minutes, I know that's a lot of time, but I think that it will really set the tone for not only for this meeting, but just really just to hear from three of our clients who are on video to share their experience with child abuse, with developmental disabilities, and with the Parkland shooting. So could I ask for that time?
Yes, okay. We look forward to watching the video.
Okay, all right. I promise you it'll be worthwhile.
Thank you.
Facebook post and it hit, it blew up and it went viral. And our phone started ringing off the hook. We knew that we had to go there immediately to make sure that he was safe. So I got in my car and I went there and the doctors were 100% right. The birth parents were more like teenagers. They just didn't know what to do with the baby. They didn't know what to feed him. They didn't know when to change his diaper. They just didn't know how to care for him. And I was terrified that if he didn't get removed from that environment, that he would die. And so we called everyone that we possibly could. We had to get this baby saved. And finally they agreed, so we went before the courts and we told them everything that we saw and all of our concerns.
Our duty is to make sure that this child is safe. And the only way that we can accomplish that is by placing this child in foster care.
And because he was Jewish, he came into one of Jatco's foster homes.
So we got a call on Friday, we wanted to take in this little boy, 10 days old. Boy, 10 days? What?
Fostering 101 is reunification. Reunification with the birth parents.
We wanted to stay with us until the whole situation was rectified.
So that's really just the beginning of our work. From that point on, we had to make sure Aaron had everything that he needed in his foster home. We would also do visitation. And I would supervise visits twice a week for 2 hours with Aaron and his birth parents. And those visits were painful, really painful. He would cry for the entire 2 hours. And he would cry for his parents, which for him in that moment were the Legatos. Those were the only parents that he knew. The court gives the birth parents a minimum of 9 months to rehabilitate. But that's just the minimum. It could go on for much longer than that, for years, until the courts reach a final decision.
Gunshots ring out in this South Florida high school, terrified students hiding in classrooms during the gunman's rampage.
I was there that day. The firewall went off and we didn't hear the first several shots. So we walked outside and we saw a herd of kids running back in while we were armed like maybe 40 feet out of the bus loop. So we all ran back in
me and my friend was back behind us, and there was the entire class behind us, 10 kids and 5 staff. Me and my friend took turns. Two kids in the wheelchair, so we take apart the wheelchair and then we run from inside. So this watching came in, you know.
Hey, everyone on the floor! Everyone on the floor!
Looking back, if he had been on the other side of school, it's really wishing now that maybe I would have not been here today.
Sophia is out of school, and she can hold a part-time job. And she can have the self-sufficiency to be at home. Before we started with JAFCO, I would have had to have had somebody home with her all day, every day. Everybody's now with me in basically a bachelor pad. It's a one-bedroom apartment. I went from working 16 hours a day, 15 hours a day, to having two little boys who were in elementary school who were home by between 1 and 2 p.m., so I could only work suddenly 4 hours. I was on the verge of putting my children in foster care because I just couldn't do it. JAFCO absolutely came and they saved us. absolutely save this. Mike Jackwell, he's made it, found me a house that I could afford. It's 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, and it's the same price as my 1-bedroom apartment. I can tell you this, the J in Jaffco stands for Jewish, but it doesn't matter. I'm from a Latin American background. They gave me a Christmas tree, presents for my 5 children. I could never do that, ever. There's no way. No. Excuse me. I bring my 3 children on the spectrum to respite care. I can actually spend a real day with my 2 typical children. And without that, I know that I wouldn't be able to. The only place that's not my home that I feel comfortable with my children coming. Only place. I have scheduled respite a couple of times to go on a couple of dates myself.
But you're available.
I'm available, that's right.
For 4 long years, we tried to help Aaron's parents build the skills that they would need to parent Aaron safely. But at the end, it was clear that they just weren't capable of keeping him safe. And so we had to advocate for Aaron. And if we weren't going to do it, we had no one. So we went to court, and it was torture waiting for the judge's decision.
Aaron has always had 100% support from JAFCO. Anything we needed.
The conclusion is that they gave him the rights for adoption, and we adopted Aaron.
I will stand by.
Is our song now?
I will help you through. When you know all you can do, you can't call.
I don't always feel that I am doing for Aaron as much as he can do. He gives us so much. If it wasn't for Jeffco, Aaron may not even be here. They did save his life. Thank you to their supporters. Thank you to everybody who ever has anything to do with Jeffco.
I will stand by. I will help you through. When you die,
saved not only my life, my 5 children's life. Thank you. Thank you for everything that you've done. You have changed our lives. Thank you. Thank you for helping me become a real father.
Yeah, I know you can make it, 'cause I will stand by you. I will help you through. When you've done all you can do, and you can't go.
So I want to devote my very being and my meaning and my life to helping people, because people help me, and there's a lot more people who need help than this year. We need to keep going. We need to always think, you know, there's always another kid out there who really could be suffering, that can help. Even if it's just one more kid.
So I will stand by you. I will help you through. When you've done all you can do, and you can't go.
as I said, Chapter is an amazing program. If you haven't visited the Ability Center here, really, truly is a place that will show you a broken heart and then heal it at the same time. And they are truly heroes. And I think that that video is amazing as it is, really underestimates the great work that they do and the heroes that they are. With that being said, we're going to move into another one of our speakers and another hero, Sheriff Gregory Tony. Sheriff, and I'll apologize that we're not running as efficiently as the Supervisor of Elections, but we will get to you soon, Supervisor Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and to the entire committee, thank you for giving me an opportunity to come here and speak to you all. It's been a while since I had an opportunity to come in and talk to the delegation. We all know COVID was part of the hindrance, and then just the nature of how fast things occurred for us to respond. But it's important for you to be here. We have a partnership relationship with you all, and we are not going to be able to have continued success in this organization without you. To begin with, there's four items of interest that we really need your support on to ensure that we continue to expand some of the different technologies we've already invested in to safeguard the community, and also just for the sake of what's been occurring for a long time within CTIS, our Child Protective Investigative Services. We're going to need some help there. I'll take a few moments to touch on it. But the four main items that we have here that are listed out is one, seeking appropriations for a digital forensic unit. Mr. Chairman, I know you've already taken that on as the bill sponsor for that. The other item we have is the first responder designation for 911 telecommunicators. The third is that CPIS, the 8% funding rollover. And then the last item that we have in terms of interest is the takeover rides, which is a expansion on legislation so that we can handle some of these different events that are occurring. The wheels up, guns down kind of phenomenon that occurs every single year when it comes around Martin Luther King holiday. So I'm going to roll into each and every one of these just for sake of talking about the importance behind it. To begin with, the digital forensic unit. We are currently in a position where we are going to exceed our capability if we do not expand and build infrastructure for our digital forensic unit, but quite frankly, all capacities when it comes to crime scene, intelligence, gathering, things of that nature. That's a vital element and ensures that we're going to be successful in how we prosecute and bring ultimate justice amongst those who commit crimes. And so that item of $500,000+ will be well spent and ensure that we have the necessary tools and advancements in technology to continue to have success in how we prosecute individuals. The second item on here, when we start talking about the first responder designation, and this one weighs a little bit heavier today, earlier this morning. For some of you, you were able to make it. Let me step back and say thank you for those who were able to attend. We honored our non-fallen individuals that we lost from COVID-19. We lost more than most in this region. And that included members of our telecommunication staff, our 911 call takers. This has been an issue of discussion in this state so long as I've lived here. And I moved here back in 1998. And it was an issue then, and it still is an issue prevalent in what we need to be looking at. One of my 911 call takers, I'll just share the example, Makima Thompson, who lost her life through COVID, was unable to take a day off and unable to avoid coming to work. This is a constant theme for all 911 and dispatchers. We, as the ones who wear the star on our chest or the badge on our chest, get the privilege and kind of designate her as the first responders. But the reality of it is the men and women who pick up the phone and listen to you or your loved one screaming for help under some of the most dire situations are the first responders. The things that they do on the phone, the way they perform, impacts not only the safety of the community, but it impacts the safety of my men and women who are responding to these calls. And there have been several states here in the country, from Georgia, California, Texas, New York, and several others who have already taken this leap forward to change the designator to make sure that we can recognize the type of work that these individuals are doing and give them the appropriate benefits when they retire. I can tell you I've spoken to my colleagues at the Florida Sheriff's Association, and what initially started where a small percentile of us was in agreement with that philosophy is now getting close to the majority. And I think the more we can push this, both from the Sheriff's Association, myself, and then your support up in the Tallahassee, I think we can get this done. If you have not ever had a chance to go into a dispatch center and spend some time and watch these men and women work and what they do and what they have to handle, I take an open invitation. Every single one of you take an opportunity to do it. It's amazing. And I'm in my 16th year in the profession, and I would never want to be a 911 call taker or dispatcher. Because the type of stress that is compounded on them, imagine, you get a 911 call, someone's drowning in a pool, the kid's out the pool, they're providing CPR instructions, they're providing all these life-saving techniques, they're making sure our personnel are getting there timely and safely and effective. And then they hang up, and the next call they pick up is, there's an officer down, he's shot. There's no break in between what they do. They absorb it all. And I went a little bit longer on that because I think if we champion anything, if we're going to fight for anything, that will be the number one item on my list. I'm telling you, these men and women deserve it. And it's every single year. I'm in my third year now as the sheriff for the agency. Every single year, this is an issue of discussion that comes up amongst our union representation that represent our dispatchers as well as our command staff, is when are we going to get this to happen? So again, that's a big ticket item there. Another consideration when it comes to CPIS and the 8% funding rollover, for those of you who are not familiar of how this works out, the Broward Sheriff's Office is one of pretty much a half a dozen sheriff's offices who, going back to 1999, had took on kind of an experimental process to see, could the sheriff's office handle the responsibilities of DCF, Department of Children and Families? Could a sheriff's office take on investigating and safeguarding the children? And again, only a half a dozen of us out of 66 sheriff's office was wrapped into that process. And we operate utilizing grant funding that is afforded through DCF through the state. But that grant funding has not been modified or shifted for the economic times from 1999 to 2021. It's the exact same grant funding that existed 20, 30 years ago. We need to change that structure. One of the more prohibiting things about how this grant is set up, we don't get the opportunity to use funds that are not expended. And so we're returning almost $1 million every year. And people say, well, Sheriff, why aren't you using it? The way some of the funding works out, it gives us an opportunity, or if we were to keep it, it would give us an opportunity to hire more people, give these men and women necessary raises and bumps, because the current legislation and how it's designed out, we can't even get independent funding from the county. If the county wanted to institute, or if I put forth a line item in our budget and said we need $10 million more, legislation doesn't even allow us to do that. It's prohibited. So one of the things I was hoping to see, and I know Christine, I didn't see her today, but I know she's going to be championing this aspect, is under getting the state aspect to see, one, we're well overdue. To expect a sheriff's office to this size, taking care of a population of over 1.9 million people, and to receive no funding consideration or modification for almost 30 plus years, we're doing our community a disservice. So that's an important one as well. Then the last item that we have here is to take over the riots. We kind of already jumped into that, but every single year we have to conduct a massive operation, which is all traffic generated. And what happens is, on Martin Luther King birthday, individuals take it upon themselves to use his name in justification that they're going to go out and do street stunts and jump sidewalks and lock down streets and dominate the I-95. And every single year, as we execute this traffic control operation, we find guns on the street, we take guns off people, we have people with drugs on them, we have people with warrants, people from outside of the state who come here and utilize our community, our environment, for a big spring break show of riding on motorcycles, putting people's lives in danger. And I've been out there, I've seen it last year, individual in the ATV almost ran over a lady with her kid in a stroller. So the legislative element that we're requesting, we have worked with the Florida Highway Patrol to make sure we stiffen up penalties that will make it much more punitive on the individuals who are participating in these events. Why is this significant? we're starting to see the same customers. It's the exact same people we arrested 2 years ago. We're arresting them again and again and again. Because the way the legislation is outlined, most of these things are turning into a slap of the wrist and are not being prosecuted. So some of the language that was placed in there, again, Major Chandler, who's one of our core partners from FHP, did a bang-up job with our personnel to help get a strong bill that Senator Book, and I think it's Anthony Rodriguez, that will be pushing from the House side. Collectively, those are our four areas of concern. I hope to have your support and efforts throughout every single one of these battles. I know it's not going to be easy, but they're most certainly worth fighting for. So with that, if there's any questions for me, I'll pause.
Members, any questions for the sheriff? Go ahead, couple more comments. Question for a comment. I think you did such a good job with the presentation that we have no questions.
I'm out.
No. I think we had a comment from Rep. Woodson, and I think we all agreed that you could use additional funds to help make our streets safer, and those of us who are backing your bills will certainly fight to help you. I, for one, have a bill where the monetary amount in that bill hasn't changed in Florida since 1999. It's not a criminal bill, but I think there's a lot of antiquated amounts, and I appreciate the point that you're bringing to our attention, especially in Broward County. I traveled from Brevard today, and the highways in northern Florida are so much better, brighter, and we give back. We give way too much money and we don't get enough back. So I know that, I speak for the rest of the delegation. We're all up there fighting for money to bring home for agencies such as yours.
No, we appreciate it. And I know we did have, we were on the brinks of having some success with some of the things that we pushed up, similar to the items here last year. And then, of course, with COVID, the governor ended up striking through a lot of items. But we know you all have fought hard for much of this that we've already talked about.
Rep. Woodson, could you answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Gregory Tony, for your leadership and the significant memorial that we had this morning for your men and women. Your leadership is seen, it's felt, and it's appreciated as well with Broward County. In light of what's going on, we heard about your request, and definitely I'm pretty sure my colleagues and I, we will do the best that we can in order to support what you're trying to do. In light of what's going on with the 911 first responders, which you mentioned exactly what their tasks are, what they do, what they are responsible for, what does mental health look like for you at the Sheriff's Department, and what do you expect us to do in order to help with the mental health crisis that we're dealing with, especially for the first responders and your men and women in the force?
Well, great. First, thank you for attending. I did spot you in the back earlier today. I picked you out of the crowd. But it was most certainly an important moment for us to honor our fallen. And to the details of your question, I think one of the biggest things I've learned over the last 3 years leading up the agency is we had to do a better job in terms of how we provide mental health opportunities for our personnel. I saw the video a moment ago, and it brought back a lot of memories, some good, some bad. But when I came into the organization, I was shocked in the fact that over a year after MSD's tragedy, our personnel who had responded to that incident and had to carry these individuals out and had to witness all these different atrocities had yet to get involved in some form of employee assistance program, mental health awareness, which tells me we're lacking there. And so we built out a coalition of different mental health care experts from across the county, including our own agency, that will ensure we're able to have crisis intervention debriefs for these major incidents and for the ones at a more micro level, because we're always dealing with trauma out there. Another thing that we've launched is a partnership with NSU. Nova Southeastern University has an outstanding clinical psychology program. I'm biased, did my master's there, I'm in school now, and they're my doctorate. However, what they offer is to bring in a level of expertise in that medical field, and we're working on building out our own internal program to expand how we are treating our own personnel. And to your point, our 911 and communication specialist historically have always been left out of that element. The focal point, again, has always been on my firefighters, our deputies, because we're in the field. But there is a trauma that exists when you have to answer a 911 call, and for 5 minutes you're trying to save someone's life, and then you hang up with no conclusion of knowledge about what occurred. It's left in their imagination as to whether or not the person died. It's left in their imagination as to whether or not they performed well. These are all traumas that add up inside of this dispatch center for the personnel. So we will not vacate our responsibility there to make sure we're providing the necessary service to treat them as well. I'm going to pivot off really quickly and talk about the importance of this as a community standpoint. We spend roughly $300 million a year to maintain care, custody, and control of individuals in jail inside of our facilities. We ran through roughly 45,000 people in our care or through our jails this past year. We currently occupy about 80% of the bed space, so meaning maximum bed space is 4,500 roughly beds. We're at 3,000 plus. We start analyzing and looking at who's coming into our care and what is that type of breakdown in terms of, are these individuals suffering from mental health? And the answer is overwhelming majority of them are. Some form of clinical diagnosed issue is occurring, schizophrenia, bipolar, you name it. I think the last time we looked at this, about 64% of that 3,000 that's coming in, we are providing some form of service. Why I give you the long dance about that? We need to start providing those services outside the jail before they come into our care and custody. Now, for anyone who is a historian, you will know that the deinstitutionalization of our health, our state health centers, started going away in this country during the mid-70s. And we had men who no longer had psychiatric hospitals. We vacated many here in the state. And the byproduct of that is more and more people were out in our community that doesn't have access to mental health care, whether it be because they can't afford it through insurance or employment, or whether it be the fact that it's just not accessible for them, it's not readily accessible. So one of the challenges that we've undertaken as an organization is to find partners who are specializing in this area to find out what ways can we reduce arrests for people that suffer from mental illness and deflect them into the necessary care that they need. I'll give you two scenarios behind some of the things we've done. Within our real-time crime center, a facility we built out over a year and a half ago, designed initially to safeguard our schools. We have access to over 17,000 camera systems in our school now. Our threat management team goes out, work with these individuals when we're going to calls that may identify somebody who has a mental illness. And they're talking about causing harm, but there's no crime. They're talking about shooting up the school, but there's no crime. Well, we embedded 4 licensed mental health care specialists into our threat management division. We took 2 from federal grants from the Department of Justice that we were to hire, and then we budgeted 2 more. What does that look like? In the past, we were somewhat negligible in how we would handle dealing with people with mental illnesses. And then it later escalated into one of our worst tragedies in American history over at MSD. Well, now, for every single time we are encountering somebody in the field and we're investigating them, but there's nothing we can arrest them on, but we identify some mental illness, we place them into programming, and we continue to monitor and manage their ability to get care. Out of the 212 incidents that we've gone out to with our behavior licensed specialists, that's the title, we end up putting 63 individuals into care of a mental health provider. That's significant because that means, one, people want the help when we offer it to them. Not all of them is accepted, but 63 is a good number. And then of that 63, it's left to our imagination, well, how many of them do we prevent from shooting up the next school? That simple investment goes a long way. And the last thing I'll talk about with this related to your question is what we've done in the area of, we've been working to create a co-responder program. co-responding program been talked about and experimented with since George Floyd in a multitude of different states. Co-responder model looks like this. You have law enforcement arriving to the scene, but they're supported with psychologists, psychiatrists, licensed therapists, whatever that would look like. And we have a construct together, partnering up with NSU and many others to see what that's going to look like. And we're going to launch another pilot pretty soon. All right.
Sheriff, I appreciate the responses. I've got two more people who want to question this. We're going to keep you up here for a few more minutes, but hopefully we get Senator Jones has a question for you.
Sure.
Just asking, we've got another 20 speakers behind you.
You can't give me a microphone. I've got to pull this thing from in front of me.
Supervisor of production comes up after you. You have to win your next election, I'd be very short.
No, but this is my will be quick. This is actually a response to Representative Woodson, that the sheriff and his team were extremely helpful last year on the first responders for 911. We were actually really close to getting a hearing in the Senate on this, Representative Woodson. It was stopped by one member who is no longer the chair of that committee. So we might have a better chance this year because I believe a lot of the senators, if I'm not mistaken, Senator Farmer knows that we're very in favor of this on both sides of the aisle, Republican and Democrat. So whoever the senator is who's carrying that, I think it'd be good to do that again because there's a different chair for the committee now.
Okay. Yeah. And now I think we have Representative Baldwin, who is the Florida School Board Legislator of the Year.
My comment is, so we have the bill putting 911, Senator Anna Maria Rodriguez from Senate, I have the House, but we're getting your help because we did include the 911 operators into PTSD, and there is a competing bill to include 911 operators altogether. And we have received a resolution from the Miami-Dade County Commission supporting our bill, and here. So my question is, or my ask of you is just to help because Miami-Dade County Commission is behind it. It is for them to be included in the emergency competences as well as the corrections officers. And, you know, it came from your staff, of course, Robin. And the other part of the bill is to work with the University of Central Florida, who created a whole department around first responder PTSD. And so we added additional language for real trauma therapy, but we need help getting it moving, and we need to get your support. We need big ask, but that's what I needed, knowing that there is a bill for one group that excludes that group is going to be a heavy lift now. And my bill has to go through the committee of the person who is sponsoring the bill for just the one group. So all the help, I know you can come up there during priorities or whenever to try to help us move that. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
because they are like the forgotten group that 911 operators. Sure. People don't understand. If you listen to the MSD commission meetings, I hear every 911 call, and I don't know how they do it. So I appreciate you advocating for them. So thank you.
Absolutely. You have my support as well.
Well, with that, again, thank you so much for coming. I appreciate you and everything that you do.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you all for giving me an extra minute or two to go.
Supervisor Scott.
Give him 2 minutes.
Another great elected official who was just through his first major election with a recount, but other than that, no other issues, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all. It's great to be here with you this afternoon. Thank you all for giving me a chance to come down here and discuss the things that are really important to my office and my team and to the voters of Broward County as we move forward with another session where we expect to see another bill that's going to come through that will be designed to make it more difficult for people to vote, specifically to vote by mail. As our chair just mentioned, we did just conclude an election. In this election, we had about 40,000 people voted. And of those 40,000 people, nearly two-thirds of them voted by mail. So a lot of that happened because of COVID and because people signed up for vote by mail as a way of avoiding in-person voting during the height of the pandemic last year in 2020. And then they received a ballot in the mail this year because their vote by mail ballots haven't been canceled yet as a response to SB 90. That's actually going to happen next December. And then we'll probably see a huge drop off in our voter participation here in Broward County as a result. It's clear that our voters prefer this method of voting. And I'm asking you all to do, you know, whatever you can to protect this and to help in anything I can do to help, please let me know because I'm more than willing to participate and help to try to defend people's rights to vote. The other thing is that our governor has expressed that he does not approve of use of drop boxes. And that makes me concerned because since my time, I've actually expanded the use of drop boxes in Broward County. It's my plan to have 8 drop boxes available for the last couple of days of the election. And let me just put this into context a little bit. We have 22 early voting sites that we've been using for the last few cycles now. And people can drop off their vote by mail ballots at those 22 early voting sites. But early voting ends at 7 p.m. on Sunday. And then you have this 48-hour period of time where there's really only 2 places, our 2 offices, where you can drop off. Now, in 2023 or early 2024, we're going to move our team into 1 building. So that means for all of Broward County, for this huge county population of nearly 2 million people, we'll have 1 location that they can go and drop off their ballots. So in order to get ahead of this problem, I opened up a number of satellite or branch offices across the county, and 8 of those, which is really insufficient. If it were up to me, I would probably have 40 locations that people could drop off their ballots, and I think 40 locations would be barely sufficient. And that would just maybe be 1 in every city, and maybe 2 or 3 in the larger cities. I mean, 40 is a pretty humble number when you think about it. But because of the way the state has set this up and the way that the election law is written, I can only have those drop boxes for those last 2 days at a branch office. And I have to staff that branch office continuously. It has to be a permanent location. So there's been some talk, and you all may already be aware, that they may try to make the restrictions on those branch offices even greater, which I would consider that to be a direct, a direct response to the steps that I've taken in the past year to make voting more accessible to the people of Broward County. In this most recent election, we've gotten to a point now where only 5 votes separate the 2 candidates. So it might be shocking to hear that 273 ballots that were postmarked before Election Day did not reach us in time to be counted. Many of our voters do not trust the Postal Service and want to drop their ballots off to us directly by using drop boxes. And they are right. These people are losing their right to vote because, perhaps because of a dysfunction in the Postal Service. Why would it ever take a piece of mail more than a day to travel from, say, Parkland to Fort Lauderdale? Some of these ballots were mailed on October 21st. Some states do have a law that allows ballots that were postmarked before Election Day to be counted. But of course, in Florida, that ballot has to reach us by 7 p.m. on Election Day, otherwise that ballot can never be opened. We currently have a setup that's requiring us to waste, and potentially, depending on how they pass this new law, may cause us to waste a lot more taxpayer dollars. We really need to have these drop boxes across Broward County, and if they put more restrictions in place that says that we have to, say, staff our branch offices 40 hours a week, you're just asking us to spend a lot of money in order to have drop boxes available when election time comes. We're already doing this with the way that we handle vote by mail ballots and the fact that we're going to cancel every vote by mail ballot request next December, even for people who are super voters who've been voting forever. And it's not going to be easy for them to get back on our list of vote by mail applicants either, because many of these people, if they registered to vote before the motor voter law was passed in the early 90s, we don't have the identifiers that SB 90 requires us to have in order to accept a vote by mail request online through our online portal or over the phone or in writing. So they would have to re-register to vote and update their identifiers in order to be able to request to vote by mail ballot. This disproportionately impacts our seniors, and people are very, very confused and angry about this change and about the fact that we're asking them for private information that they've never had to provide. In one case, we had a man call the office who's been voting for over 80 years. He's 101 years old and doesn't understand why all of a sudden there's new requirements on him in order for him to be able to vote by mail, which he's been doing for a very long time. Another big problem that came out of SB 90 is the fact that a lot of people were concerned about the fact that we had very wealthy Americans who donated money to elections offices to help get through COVID. And understandably, perhaps, that we don't want billionaires interfering in elections and elections offices. But the way that the statute was written, it makes it so that it's virtually impossible for any civic-minded people to volunteer to help their elections office. It makes it impossible for me, as the supervisor of elections, to help charitable organizations that are focused on voting issues, because the law is written in such a strict way that I could never solicit any money that has anything to do with voter education or voter registration. Whereas I'm the main person in the community that these organizations will look to help them to operate. I have to be, I have to restrict myself and restrict my own freedom of speech and what I say in support of these agencies, because if somebody perceives me as soliciting funds to help them, then that could be a violation of SB 90. But more so than for someone like myself, it's for the kids, the young people, even teenagers who are trying to get community service hours for high school and things, and they want to volunteer and help our office. The way SB 90 is currently written, it restricts that. So we have a provision that was designed to prevent Mark Zuckerberg from donating to our office. And what it's doing is it's preventing high schoolers from volunteering for our office. We really have to relook that language and find a way to write that statute so that civic-minded young people can still participate and still help out. And that we don't have to waste money on things, on products and services that we could have gotten for free. We're wasting taxpayer dollars. I mean, multiple things that are happening here are just really, it's just a waste of taxpayer dollars. And supposedly the folks who are putting this in place are supposed to be the ones who are against that. But in this case, they seem to be doing a lot more of it. So I'm gonna finish off, before I finish my last point, I do wanna say that we could create a list maintenance process for the vote by mail system. The same way that we maintain our voter registration rolls, we could have a list maintenance process for vote by mail that removes people who are not using the vote by mail system, but doesn't remove people who use it on a regular basis. And that we, you know, are certain they've been living at the same address for 20, 30 years. You know, there's guidelines that we can put in place to make sure that these longtime super voters can continue to get their vote by mail ballot and aren't cut off next year while maintaining the integrity that they say they're looking for. So the last point that I want to make is the fact that for an elections official, somebody who's really concerned, who has a diverse community of voters, I'm really concerned about this idea of having a new law enforcement agency to police voting. So, you know, this is something that we've seen in the past, that we've stopped in the past, of trying to push back that law enforcement presence at our polls. And there was actually a consent decree that expired in 2017 that actually prevented some of these type of measures from being put in place. And now, along with the weakening of the Voting Rights Act, we've really created this perfect storm where somebody who wants to interfere in elections can now put a heavier law enforcement presence at the polls, intimidate voters, and reduce voter turnout in areas where they don't want to see too many voters. So this is a major, major emergency and something that we have to fight as hard as we can to prevent it from happening. And with that, I will take your questions.
Supervisor Scott, you know, we all know you have a very difficult job, and that SB 90 didn't make it any easier. We appreciate your vigilance and the things that you're doing proactively to help people ensure that they have the opportunity to vote. With that, I know that Rep. Geller, indicated if he has a question or comment for you.
Sure. Do I need to use this or no?
Yep.
Figure it out. Thank you. Need these young folks to.
Yes, sir. Test it. It's not over.
Someone share with you?
Okay. Is this working?
Yes.
So thank you, and thank you, Senator. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. And thank you, Senator.
No problem.
Supervisor Scott, I want to start by thanking you for your outstanding efforts to promote increased vote. I mean, that's one of the jobs you have. Well, you know, you got to count them, got to get them right, but you also got to encourage people, and you're doing, at least in my opinion, an outstanding job of reaching out to all the elements of this diverse community and making sure that people have the opportunity to cast their vote. If there's something that's sacred in our secular system of government, it's the right to vote. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate that, Representative Gallo. Thank you.
Couple of quick comments and questions. Is there any reason why everybody shouldn't just get that opportunity to cast their vote by mail and let them make a choice? I mean, is there any reason why we have to wait for them to say, well, maybe I want to do that, instead of just offering them that opportunity and making them aware of it?
No, it's really a lot more efficient. You know, if we were to, and some jurisdictions have already gone to, all vote by mail system. I mean, there are better things for us to spend our money on than elections, and conducting our elections in the most efficient way possible, you know, would be for everybody to vote by mail.
I mean, I'm not saying that we should deny somebody. You know, we do have people who were, they want to go there and they want to hand that ballot in, and I respect that. Whether we encourage them to do it early so they don't have to wait in line on election day, or just come down on the day that we set for it, which ought to be a holiday, but that's another story. So I'm not saying we should deny anybody the opportunity, but if we just made it where every single person just had that and could just say, yeah, you know, I want to send my vote in by mail just in case it's raining or I don't feel good. Any reason not to do that at all?
No, I can't imagine why. And one of the things we're working on is to get everybody to stop thinking about election day is one day, and that's the last day, and don't wait till the last day, because you're exactly right. If it's raining, or if you get sick, or if anything happens, and you wait until that last day, then you end up not voting at all. It's better to go ahead and vote early.
I always see people, when I work the polls, they pull up 5 minutes late, you know, they hit traffic, and they get turned away. So,
absolutely.
Let's talk about drop boxes for just a minute. I mean, the circumstances you think are dire. The idea that you have to have somebody in some location 40 hours a week just to be able to have people use those drop boxes. But in particular, let me ask you, is there any loss of security or integrity or the ability to verify anything if somebody comes up to that drop box sitting in their car instead of having to park and find it and walk in and, you know, beat the crowds at early voting?
Yeah, no, so, and I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because one of the things SB 90 did was it created a 150-foot no solicitation zone around the drop box, which creates, what we found in this most recent election was that we ended up having to make all these compromises. So either we are denying candidates their First Amendment rights to, to campaign near the polling sites, or we're obstructing traffic by having the drop box in a place that's really inconvenient for the flow of traffic in order for us to set up the drop box somewhere that doesn't disrupt the campaigning efforts. So we did end up having a challenge with that. And the craziest thing about it is no one is pulling up to a drive-through drop box and then making their decision about who to vote for.
It's not.
So nobody is going to be influenced or impacted by this no solicitation zone. It doesn't make sense for candidates to focus on those drop boxes and to try to solicit votes at a drop box. The people have already voted.
It's already signed and sealed envelopes.
It's signed and sealed. Exactly. So, I mean, that's one of those things that would just be really easy to give us more latitude. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm baffled by the fact that we as local, as elected constitutional officers, can't make these decisions at the local level and do what's best for our communities, that the state is putting all these restrictions on us and making it difficult for us to do our job.
And I want to talk about that. I'm sorry, and I typically avoid colorful language, but the despicable notion that we're going to create some super police whose job is to do nothing but to hang around certain places where they'd rather not, they would rather not have too much voting, and intimidate or discourage people. What, if any, measures are being introduced or even contemplated to see that that super election police is not used in a selective or discriminatory manner?
I mean, that's something that we would have to definitely spend some time thinking about what we'll do to try to make the public feel comfortable, because nobody wants to, you know, and that's why we see that there's just not, you don't really see significant amounts of fraud in elections. There's over 100 million people in this country who are eligible to vote and just don't. If you want to increase the vote, you don't need to commit fraud. You go and get more people to vote, right? You can put that effort towards that. So nobody is willing to risk jail time to add one or two more votes. And intimidating people and making people feel uncomfortable about going to vote is one of the worst things that can be done. It's been used throughout American history to discourage certain communities from participating. And with the weakness that we have in our Voting Rights Act as a result of the Supreme Court overturning or invalidating some of the sections of the Voting Rights Act, we've now created this opening for those same tactics that we used 50, 75 years ago to come right back here in the 21st century. And that's exactly what we see with this plan to create a new election law enforcement agency.
Yeah, 50, 75, 25, 10, 5 years ago, and last week. Encouraging people is fine, but there's just no way that you can make sure that those super police or whatever they are not used in a selective and discriminatory fashion. Like you said, it's been used on certain communities, and we know what that's and where it is. Last, Supervisor, the last thing I want to raise with you is, I understand that the misguided legislation that passed last year that had all these mistakes and glitches in addition to the deliberate attempts. I mean, to tell a 101-year-old that he has to come up with information, how is there not some kind of an exception for people who've been registered and voting at the same address for 20 years or more? Just despicable, again, is the only word. But I just want to say, you know, I understand that many of these things are inefficiencies. I appreciate the fact that you could do better if you were allowed to do better, that you could save money, that you could be more efficient. But I want to tell you, Supervisor, that it seems to me the most important thing is that we hear from all the people. I don't care if they agree with me or not. We just need to hear from all the people, and we just need to do whatever it takes to get them to vote. So I just will say to you that since it's been taken out of your hands to be able to do this as efficiently as possible, don't worry so much about the efficiency. I know you do the best you can, and you're doing a great job. But, you know, since people have made it more or less impossible for you to do the job efficiently, just keep doing the job. And if it turns out not that efficient, that's not your fault. That's the people who put all these unnecessary restrictions on you. Don't let them stop you from doing what you're doing, making sure as many people as possible get the right to vote. Thank you for what you're doing, sir. Thank you.
Supervisor Scott, we have two additional comments or questions. First, Senator Palmer.
Yeah, echo what Senator Taylor said. Thank you for everything you're trying to do to enfranchise more people rather than disenfranchise more people. It's very frustrating. I look up and down this podium. I don't think a single member here voted for SB 90. We're sorry that that came out of the Florida legislature. It's an abomination. It's an affront to everything that we hold sacred about democracy. And I just can't help but note the irony that one party calls the other party socialist, yet that party that calls the other party socialist enacts socialist anti-voting legislation, not just here in Florida, but all over the country. We talked about trying to be nonpartisan. None of us want to be partisan on this. Voting should not be partisan. But we also got to call it the way it is. And everybody up here is going to continue to fight and do what we can to get rid of these horrible laws. And it's a shame that it takes away the discretion of a constitutionally elected officer such as yourself to just try to do your job with absolutely no evidence of fraud, which is the supposed basis for these un-American laws. So thanks for everything you're doing, Supervisor.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate that.
And it's funny because I just want to say, we you just said, we have a majority up in Tallahassee who, as you said, enacted those laws which are socialist, and at the same point in time is building a bigger police force and now looking for a statewide OSHA. So the government under their rule was not getting any smaller, it's getting bigger. Senator Polsky.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Supervisor. I'm working on a special elections bill to create actual timelines where we would hold special elections. So we would love your input on that. It can be sent into your office. So let's chat about that because it's very important to get the timing right. And perhaps if you could just explain briefly to whoever's listening how many people will be unrepresented after January 11th and how long that would last, if you know.
So I'll tell you, in District 20, it was, we had, as far as voters, there were 249,000 people that were actually registered voters here in Broward County that live in that District 20, and a lot of that overlaps with the district, Senate District 33 and House District 94, which are having special elections at the same time. So in this upcoming session, it will literally be hundreds of thousands of people, disproportionately African-American communities. You know, I mentioned 249,000, but there's probably three times as many people actually living there, because a lot of immigrants in these communities and a lot of young people as well were part of the population and part of who those representatives are there to represent. So close to a million people possibly that are losing out on representation in the legislature because of basically partisan gamesmanship with the timeline. We could have done these elections simultaneously. It would have been easier and more efficient and saved us a lot of money if we had done the election simultaneously, but our governor chose not to. And I definitely would love to help with that legislation, and anything we can do to help, I appreciate it, Senator. We'd love to be part of it.
I think that was the longest delay in, 20 or 25 years?
Yes.
Like ever?
Or like ever, as Joe said. Again, thank you so much. Any additional questions or comments or concerns? Okay. So with that being said, thank you so much. We appreciate your time. Sorry that we're running late. My apologies to everybody else if we're running late. Supervisor, thank you. If there's anything we can do to help you, you know how to find us all, and we're here to support you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Everybody have a great day. Thank you so much.
And members of the public, we've got two matters to address before we get to you and we get to our public speakers. I'm going to take a roll call vote, so I'll ask Senator Farmer if I can step out for a brief personal matter to come back, but while he's doing that, we'll take the roll real quick so we can establish a quorum. He's here. I knew he would lead that call.
Is this on? Can you hear me? Okay. A quorum call. This is for quorum call. Senator Polsky?
I'm here.
Senator Book? Senator Thurston? Senator Farmer?
Here.
Senator Jones?
Here.
Representative LaMarca? Representative DuBose? Representative Ontroy? Representative Hontowski? Representative Pickley? Representative Jenny?
Here.
Representative Geller?
Here.
Representative Woodson?
Here.
Representative Robinson?
Here.
Representative Fabricio? Representative Barberman?
Here.
Representative Barrera. Representative, I'm sorry, Vice Chair Williams.
Here.
Chair Gottlieb.
Present.
We have 10, we have 4.
Okay, with that being said, earlier in the session, I appointed a rules committee. Our rules have not been updated since 2016. Our membership has not taken a vote on that rules committee. We're going to take a vote.
Second.
Well, wait, I didn't do it yet. I was just stopping. So we're just going to take a quick vote. I've established a rules committee. I have appointed Senator Farmer to be on the rules committee, myself, my vice chair, Rep. Williams, Rep. LaMarca, who's not present today, but was present when we met earlier today, and Rep. Geller. So I'm going to make my own motion that we formally establish a rules committee to meet and vote in the future at a date and point in time to be announced publicly.
I second that motion.
Okay, we'll do,
sure, can we do a voice vote?
Okay. And we'll do a voice vote on that. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody not in favor of that? With that, the motion passes, and we'll move on to our next area of business. And the next area of business, for November 9th, 2021 is an annexation. We've already done a quorum call. We have a quorum. I'm going to ask our council to state the annexation received by the delegation.
A bill entitled An Act Relating to the City of Parkland, Broward County, annexing into the corporate limits of the City of Parkland an approximately 4.77-acre parcel of contiguous land located in unincorporated Broward County, providing an effective date. That is the bill.
I'd now like to call on the sponsor or any speakers for or against the annexation. And is this Mr. Jeff Evans?
No, my name is Rick Walker.
Oh. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't get my the mask on.
That's okay.
Go ahead.
I can vouch.
So my name's Rich Walker, Mayor of City of Parkland. So I came here on a good night. It's always a pleasure to see Sheriff Tony. Yes, sir?
No, it's
always great to see Sheriff Tony speak. He's doing a wonderful job. So obviously any support you guys give him is very welcome. And then obviously Joe Scott, the Supervisor of Elections, he's also a Parkland resident. So big shout out to him as well. I would be remiss to not thank JAFCO for hosting this event. As a Parkland resident and the mayor of Parkland, Eagles Haven is a wonderful partner in the city of Parkland and Coral Springs. So we appreciate everything JAFCO and specifically Eagles Haven does for our community. That being said, obviously we're talking about a just under 5-acre parcel of land in the northernmost part of Broward County that is currently not in Parkland. In our discussions with the owner has agreed to dedicate 4 acres of that parcel to the city of Parkland as a park. What we ultimately do with that park and what type of park it'll be is yet to be seen. The annexation ordinance was passed by our commission. So obviously anytime you have an opportunity to annex any parcels of land into your city jurisdiction, that's always a positive. And obviously, again, our commission agreed with that as we did pass that annexation ordinance. So I'm here for, obviously I'm in support, looking for your support for this particular annexation. So if anybody has any questions of me, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mayor, we appreciate you coming. I don't see any questions from the membership up here. So with that, again, thank you so much. If
thank
you
want
to stand by, maybe you'll have to answer someone.
Okay.
We have a speaker, Jeff Evans. Mr. Evans, you have 2 minutes.
Good evening, sir, members of the delegation. My name is Jeff Evans. I'm a land use planner. I've been working on this project for a number of years, and I would like to thank the City of Parkland for all the assistance and competent help they provided us through this, as well as the county staff. We've had to work with them on a number of occasions as well. With that, Mayor Walker, I think, summarized everything pretty well, and I'm here just basically to respond to any questions that the delegation may have.
Seeing and hearing no questions,
Seeing, hearing no questions, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being brief. All comments having been done, this is a voice vote in the matter of the City of Parkland annexation presented today, November 9, 2021. All those in favor say yay.
Yay. Yay.
All opposed say nay. And with that, the approval of the annexation is memorialized. It's favorable. Okay. I think now I can move on then to our public speakers. First up is, with that, I'm going to pass the gavel to my vice chair. I'm going to take a moment, and she will conduct the rest of the meeting. Thank you. 2 minutes, each person.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, we're going to start our public hearing. 2 minutes for each speaker. We're going to start off with Lacey Hoffmeyer from Broward College. Following her is going to be Kathy Redford for Understanding Wrongful Death Act.
Good evening, members of the delegation. It's my pleasure to represent Broward College tonight. President Hill, since his regards, he wasn't able to make it. He's at our dinner this evening, honoring him among others. I wanted to come to you all briefly to talk to you about some of the good work that Broward College has been doing. Specifically, Broward College has recently received a Promise Neighborhoods grant, $30 million over 5 years to expand President Hale's seminal project called Broward Up. This is Broward College getting out of its comfort zones and into communities, many of your communities that you represent, in order to expand the services that we provide, but do it in a very localized way. So while Broward College has beautiful campuses in Coconut Creek and Davie and in Pembroke Pines, that's not where we find the most needy residents. And so we have specifically targeted zip codes in this county with low educational attainment coupled with high unemployment. And it's amazing that Broward College has done all of this work without us using a single dollar of state support. And right now, it's because we can. The state support of the Florida college system, and particularly Broward College, hasn't kept up with inflation, while costs for Broward College have been on the rise. Tuition and fees has been fixed since 2014. There's no CPI adjuster in tuition and fees, and it's been held flat by the Florida legislature and political pressure by Governor Scott and Governor DeSantis, and that's fine. But what needs to happen on the other end is for the legislature to support all of those inflationary measures that come along with holding tuition and fees constant, and it hasn't happened. Over the past 8 years, it hasn't kept up with inflation. So when President Hale came into this role as the president of Broward College, he knew all this. He was actually in my role as the general counsel and the vice president of public affairs and had been working in Tallahassee for many, many years. And so what he saw when he came to be the president of Broward College is that all of those resources that we're going to need to do more than we already do through Broward Up is to get grants like this. I know that Senator Jones and I have been working very closely on a grant program that would scale what Broward College is doing across the state, and it's been a great pleasure to work with him in his office. But besides all of the great work that we're doing with the grants and the federal funding that we've received, what we really need is support from the state legislature. Those day-to-day operations that support what we do and all of our employees and all of the efforts that we make in order to do the things that we have to do in statute come from the appropriations from the Florida legislature. And so the Florida college system is seeking $60 million in new funds from the Florida legislature. About $52 million of that, I would say, is taken up on in inflationary or cost measures that increase year over year. Additionally, you'll hear across the state of the deferred maintenance needs of so many of the state agencies, but that includes our state universities, that includes your Florida colleges. Currently, the Florida colleges have at least $370 million in deferred maintenance needs, and so we're looking for your support in the Florida legislature this year to help us with each of those things. I'm happy to take any questions, but I really appreciate your time this evening, and I'm sure I'll see you in Tallahassee if I haven't seen you already.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kathy Redford from Understanding Wrongful Death Act.
Yes, hi.
I'm here to speak about the Understanding for Wrongful Death Act, Statute 76821. This is very near and dear to my heart because my father was a victim of this. This act is, this bill provides limitations for who can bring a lawsuit against a medical facility or a healthcare provider for medical negligence caused by wrongful death of a patient. And it, if there's a an adult over 24, adult child over 24 that died, the parent cannot seek legal recourse. Or if there's a parent that passes away that has an adult child, they cannot seek legal recourse. And it makes it a better legal outcome if the patient dies rather than if there's an injury to the medical provider. So, and Florida is one of the only states that has this law on the books, and it discriminates against different people in the community as far as unmarried, graduate students, widowed seniors, LGBT community, divorced and widowed adults whose children are no longer minors, tourists and part-time residents of Florida who are unmarried, minus a minor child, unmarried adults without a child. So this is like a law that really needs to be changed. And like I said, it affected my father. My father was a World War II veteran who went into Halifax Hospital. He walked in there. He was relatively healthy and an active senior. And he went in there and he ended up for, He went into the hospital with a, you know, relatively healthy. And he developed MRSA. He went for a routine operation, and he developed MRSA in his lungs. And he ended. He was in the ICU, and they treated him terrible. You know, it was a really bad case of malpractice. The nurse there was saying that, you know, the ICU, they could use the bed for a healthy patient. She said terrible things to my family, my sisters. That either that they could use it for a younger patient, and he had an arterial line in his neck that I saw that they had changed it in a few days, you know. So anyway, he got better. He was sitting up in bed, and they said that they were going to release him to a rehab facility and have for his leg because he had been in bed so long. And then, like 2 days later, they called me and told me that he took a turn for the worse and that he was not doing well, and then he passed away. And the reason that he passed away was sepsis, which I believe was because of the infection in the arterial line. So I asked for his records, and they said it would be $1 a page, and there were hundreds of pages, but I requested them anyway, and I consulted with an attorney who had a nurse on staff, and she told me there was definitely negligence and malpractice, but because of the way Florida law read, there was nothing I could do. But because of this, I would like to see the law changed. I'd like to see other families be able to seek recourse, and I'd like to see the four bills passed, and that this way other families.
Okay, Senator Farmer has a question for you.
Yes.
Not so much a question, but I just want to thank you, Ms. Redford, for sharing this personal story. I want to make sure, just to sum it all up, members, unfortunately what we're talking about here is it's commonly known as the free kill. And that seems like a glib, unrespectful way to say it, but that's what it is. You have to understand here, if Ms. Redford had been 24 years old when this happened, she'd be able to sue. Because she was over 24, so as a state legislature, we determined years ago that it's actionable for loss of life if the person is 24 or younger, but it's not actionable if they're 25 or older. That's just wrong. Okay, my friend Senator Jones here is not legally married, so if something were to happen to him, and he's over 24, barely over 24, I know, there would be no right for anybody to sue for that debt. Similarly, if a physician runs you over with his or her car, you can sue them. Mm-hmm. But because they killed you in a hospital setting or in an office setting, you can't sue. There's nothing fair or equitable about this. Former Senator Rene Garcia was also single, similar situation. He championed this bill for many years. This is, we love our friends in the medical profession, those of them provide outstanding care, but when things go wrong, there shouldn't be an arbitrary cutoff like this. It's just wrong, it's unequitable, it's unfair, it's arbitrary, and we need to repeal it. We thank you for working.
Thank you so much.
Representative
Jones.
Excuse me,
Ms. Rebecca?
Oh, it's okay. You can sit if you like. I was just going to, just for information's sake, last year the House did pass a bill that would have fixed this. Senate leadership, nobody on this table, certainly not Senators Farmer or Polsky, had anything to do with that bill not coming over, but the House did pass it. It was an overwhelmingly, a 99 yay votes on that. Out of our delegation, we only had one member vote against it. So overwhelmingly in your delegation and in the floor of the House were there. I think if it was on the floor of the Senate, it would probably pass as well. So that's the key. And so you are aware the bill has been filed again in the House this year at 60-11. So we'll keep an eye on that, and I'll be sure to talk to Representative Roach, who was the sponsor of that last year and then again this year. So know that, and we're working towards it, and you have the support of the floor, or the overwhelming majority of the support of the House.
Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for your time. Torin Goodman from FAM, Broward Alumni Association, followed by Ashley Boxer from Broward Health.
Good afternoon. To Sheriff Batley, Vice Chair Williams, and the entire delegation, I bring you greetings from the Broward Alumni Chapter of FAMU, National Alumni Association. My purpose here today is, of course, to introduce you to our legislative budget request, in addition to some university updates. This year, the Florida A&M University is once again the highest ranked public historically black college and university in the country. We are ranked number 104 among public universities, and that's up from 117 last year among, again, all national universities. As a leader within the state university system and affordability and providing access to first-generation and low-income students, FAMU leads 7 places to rank number 13 in U.S. News and World Report's Social Mobility Index. The university has made progress with improving our 6-year graduation rate in addition to reducing time to degree. However, support is needed to increase our 4-year graduation rate in addition to retention and licensed passenger rates. With regards to the legislative budget request, we're requesting $15 million in recurring funding for elevating and sustaining student success. This will help address these issues, which supports the state university system's strategic priority to increase student access and success. We're also prioritizing $6.6 million for the FAMU FSU College of Engineering and restoration of the recurring resources for performance-based funding. As far as a few updates, the university has celebrated 134 years of existence. Our COVID site has administered over 500,000 shots and over 500,000 tests and administered over 19,000 shots to the local community. We were awarded over $50 million in grants to address such issues as food insecurity, in addition to climate change related impacts on the U.S. agricultural production and to increase diversity within the STEM industry. As we can also see, back in May, FAMU alumna Kim Godwin became the president of ABC News. In addition, as you watch the Academy Awards next year, just note that FAMU alumnus Will Packer has been selected to be the producer for that show. We thank you for your continued support. We look forward to your favorable support this year. Best of luck this session. Best of luck to you and your teams. And once again, we thank you for your time and consideration. With that, are there any questions and or comments? All right, hearing none, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ashley Foxer, Broward Health, followed by Ellen Dressler from the Lighthouse of Broward.
Good evening, Chair Gottlieb, Vice Chair Hawkins-Williams, members, friends, and the community. I'm Ashley Boxer, I'm the Vice President of External Affairs of Broward Health, and I come before you today with gratitude to each of you for supporting Broward Health and all of our local hospitals and Broward Health's almost 10,000 caregivers during one of the most trying times in our 80-year history of the healthcare system. To give you a quick COVID-19 update, we are currently caring for under 30 COVID-positive patients throughout our enterprise. The admittance number has been on a downward trend over the last few weeks, thankfully. Out of these 30 patients, none of these individuals are pediatric patients. We will not resume community vaccination for adults or pediatric patients, but do encourage everyone in the community to follow CDC guidelines. And just a reminder that when we were doing those vaccinations, we vaccinated over 110 individuals in the county. And that was due to many local partnerships, and also want to thank you all for your involvement with that. Other updates from our home front. We just wrapped up our ID Cancer with Broward Health campaign. You may have seen the commercials, radio ads, the billboards. It was a really impactful campaign, and many of our patients that are currently getting treated right now for cancer actually said that it was very uplifting to them and encouraging. So it was really, really nice to hear that from some of our community members. We're also really excited for the upcoming holiday season. So look out for us at several events throughout the community. And of course, as we look forward to the legislative session, I just want to thank you in advance for your continued support of our issues and issues affecting all of the hospital districts across in your local districts here in Broward County. Several issues that I just wanted to bring in front of you today that I don't have enough time to talk about because of the complexity. 340B drug discount program, monitoring the Medicaid, any potential cuts to Medicaid, and of course we want to just help bring other programs back to Broward County that will help with healthcare access and different programs for everyone in our community. Thank you all so much, and I'm happy to entertain any questions. Look forward to working with you again.
Hey, Ashley, thanks for that presentation. North Broward's really doing great things.
Thank you, Senator.
I know it's been a struggle in the past, and y'all are really improving things. Now, I'm curious, why did y'all stop doing vaccinations?
Why did we stop doing vaccinations?
Uh-huh.
It got to a point, Senator, that the demand was lowered because of the amount of other sites that had opened up in the area. We had the vaccinations at three sites, at the Inter-Miami Stadium in Fort Lauderdale, across from Broward Health Medical Center, and in Broward Health North. And at the stadium site, which was the first site that we stopped their first doses at, we were seeing, our staffing that we had there outnumbered the amount of patients that we had from day to day. I mean, we got down to maybe 5-10 patients after a while because of the other ability of getting vaccinations in the community.
Okay, thanks. I think some of those private folks stopped doing vaccines as well, though, since you guys did. It's something probably we need to talk about some more, but I'll reach out to your CEO. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. Thank you for all your support.
Not seeing any more questions, Ashley. Thank you so much for coming in. I just want to tell you thank you for your updates on a weekly basis and your vigilance during the pandemic. You guys were all the hospitals, but you in particular were fantastic, and I know you helped me a couple times throughout. So thank you and appreciate your continued hard work.
Happy to help. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
Have a great evening.
Thank you, too. Next up, we have Monica Elliott from the League of Women Voters, and behind that will be Catherine Bernard from Prison Reform. Now, just as a reminder, 2 minutes each, please, so that everybody has an opportunity to address us.
Good evening, delegation. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan organization. However, we do advocate for issues we have studied and come to a consensus on. And I'm here to inform you of the League's six priority areas for the 2022 legislative session. I fully support everything that Joe Scott said, so I don't really need to go into SB 90. But there is still the issue of trying to fix Amendment 4. We want to also have the conversion of fines and fees to a civil lien to be considered a completion of the sentence for financial obligations. All you have to do is remove one word. One word would fix it all. Second, we want the fair district standards adhered to for the redistricting of the congressional and Florida legislative districts. You probably know the league stands ready to file suit if we don't get fair maps drawn in this state. Third, we want HB 167, the so-called Florida Heartbeat Act, and any similar bills that might be filed stopped. There should be no barriers to abortion access in this state. Fourth, the league wants to continue to advocate for expansion of Medicaid, as this would help to reduce the disparities in health outcomes. We saw that so much during this COVID pandemic, how this was a particular concern among our Black and Brown populations. Our fifth focus is on education. We continue to ask for adequate and equitable funding of public education. Last but not least, we support legislation focused on improving water quality and addressing the climate change and sea level rise. We also support funding for completing the Everglades Agricultural Area Reservoir Project and continuing acquisitions under Florida Forever. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for your service to the state. We know this is not an easy job, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, don't go away. I've got over the question, and I just want to thank you. I know you guys do a tremendous job, especially as it relates to the fair districts and all these others. But you know, I know we're in the past. You certainly have as it relates to the fair districts. Amendment 4, I agree with you. It's something that we all hear. Fought hard for, and we're hopeful that we'll make some changes in the course. But with that, Brent Geller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great list. Those are good ones, all good ones. Medicaid expansion, oh my God. And certainly the redistricting issues are ones we're all looking at. I just want to give a shout out for the league. I actually came here today from a league event that Palm Beach League hosted that your new state president was at.
I was there too. I saw. Oh, yeah.
What a great event it had for the benefit of the public. Michael Steele, the former lieutenant governor of Maryland, was there talking about one of my bills, which is the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And there's real momentum. You know, they have 195 votes, electoral votes already into the compact. If only Florida would join, you know, our 28 would move them way towards the 270, but they have other states targeted. And I want to say that your state president, Ms. Schoon, what a motivating speech that she gave today. So congratulations to the league, to you, to the work that all of your chapters and your state organization do. And I'm privileged to be with you today. Thank you.
Thank you. We do the NPV. We really want to have that passed out. So we've got huge list, a wish list.
Good list.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kathleen Bernard, discussing prison reform. And then I think next is Andre Gonzalez, United Way.
Good evening. There are three major prison issues that need your support. First, overcrowding and staff shortages. Overcrowding and staffing shortages in FDC are creating a precarious situation, fostering a mentally and physically unhealthy environment for inmates as well as staff. It is already resulting in inmates sleeping on concrete floors and encroaching on common areas. Currently, inmates have been denied recreation time up to 3 weeks, citing staff shortages as the reason. The potential domino effect of these conditions is and will continue to affect every aspect of prison. Second, 125-mile legislation. This legislation would require that inmates be incarcerated no more than 125 miles one way from the county of commitment or county of the family's residence. Current placements sometimes result in inmates going years without contact visits. As indicated by Maslow's hierarchy of basic needs, fulfilling belonging and love needs are critical. Maintaining family ties is primary in addressing these needs. Visitation is also especially important to inmates serving life sentences. Long distances place unnecessary financial burden on families. Citing my personal experience, my son is currently incarcerated 570 miles from home, an 8-hour nonstop drive. Calculations using current gas prices, seasonal hotel rates, and food costs, the expense of 1 5-hour visit is between $670 and $878. Please support this bill. Mail rule. The digitized mail rule that has passed is punitive and inhumane. Knowing someone they love has touched their physical mail has an enormous impact on the profound loneliness created by the almost total isolation from everyone they love. These very pieces of mail may become keepsakes for loved ones they will never see again. Additionally, there is no guarantee that a technical glitch will not wipe out stored mail. This rule pads JPay's already bulging pockets by encouraging their incompetence and insensitivity. It creates trauma with no positive outcome. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns? Seeing none, thank you so much. Appreciate you coming here today. Alejandro Gonzalez from United Way, and following Mr. Gonzalez will be Chelsea Kress.
Good evening, everyone, members of the delegation. Andrea, thank you for your service as well to our Public Policy Committee. As you may know, United Way supports our ALICE families here in this community. ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, but Employed. They are our neighbors, our family members, nurses, educators, servers, just to name a few. And you will see United Way supporting ALICE families this session by advocating in Tallahassee for items that primarily relate to three areas. The first, healthcare access. We will ask you to help us protect and augment Broward Behavioral Health Coalition's budget, and as well as support the expansion of kid care. Second is veteran empowerment. We will seek your partnership to ensure that veterans who receive medical training in the military can quickly deploy those skills in civilian life without so much red tape. The third is affordable housing. We will encourage you to support legislation that protects and expands affordable housing in our community, which continues to be our top priority at United Way, honestly. On that last point, I am thrilled to share with you that we are investing $10 million to launch United in Housing for Broward. Together with community partners, we will build an investment fund and a policy platform to help alleviate our affordable housing crisis. Our dear Marcia Barry Smith, who's here with us today, and who needs no introduction to this group, will co-lead this initiative. So in closing, I hope, and we all hope, to discuss these issues with you next Tuesday and Wednesday. We're in Tallahassee during our Capitol days. We've sent you an invitation to our reception and hope to be visiting with you individually as well. Until then, and if you have any questions, thank you so much for your service to our community and for the opportunity to speak here today. Thank you, Chair Gottlieb and Vice Chair Williams, for the chance.
Okay, thank you so much. Not seeing any questions or concerns. We look forward to seeing you next week in Tallahassee.
Thank you all. See you then.
Ms. Krebs, Chelsea Krebs. And following Ms. Krebs will be Sylvia Meyer.
Hello, and thank you to the delegation for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Chelsea Krebs. I'd like you to help reduce pollution by co-sponsoring House Bill 6063 and Senate Bill 320. Since 2003, I've been an animal care volunteer at the South Florida Wildlife Center in Fort Lauderdale. I take care of the possums. Our mission is to rescue, rehabilitate, and release native Florida wildlife. We treat, on average, 1,000 patients per month, and about 90% of the animals who come... About 90% of the animals who come into our center suffer from injuries that are the result of negative interactions with people, and this includes plastic pollution. Over the past 18 years, I've seen animals suffer and die from becoming entangled, choking, or strangling on what you call single-use plastics. Things like six-pack holders, shopping bags, plastic straws, and forks. Things that we only use for a few minutes, but last for years in our environment and cause so much suffering to the pelicans, turtles, and other animals who get caught in them. I've seen perfectly healthy animals who refuse to eat and become weak and die, only to find his intestine was blocked with a tiny piece of plastic that killed him. The solution to this problem is as simple as bringing your own tote bag to Publix and saying no thank you to things like plastic bags. And that's something that every person in this room can do every day. The state of Florida has created a ban on local municipalities banning plastic bags, but not other single-use plastics. Please co-sponsor these bills so stupid things like plastic straws and forks won't kill the animals I take care of. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. I know that Rep. Geller has a comment.
Just that I support you, and I think that what you're doing is wonderful, so good luck on it.
Thank you.
And I
did want to say one other thing, though, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I apologize for the interruption. It's getting close to 6. I thought we noticed till 6, so I was making sure that we didn't need to notice to go over. So I apologize for interrupting you when we're talking. Thank you so much. Any questions or comments for anyone else?
No. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah,
let me just say on the record, and it's not deep there. It's not about your issue. Thank you. I have to leave, so I'm going to excuse myself, but I know we have an issue sometimes with members of our delegation and people not paying attention. So I want to apologize to everybody in the audience. I'm not going to get a chance to hear. One of the difficulties of representing two counties as I do is that sometimes I have issues in both. I have a meeting I need to get to in Miami-Dade County. I'm not just, you know, cutting out because I don't want to hear or care what else is going to be said as I go home for dinner or something. But I've stayed as long as I could. I'm actually in traffic, probably late for this next meeting. To those of you who are speaking, my legislative aide is here. He's going to be remaining. He's going to take notes on everybody else who speaks. I'm keenly interested in what each of you has to say. I'm sorry I won't be here to hear it in person, but I wanted you to know that you're not being disrespected in any way, and what you've taken your time to come and testify to us, and I'm going to make sure that I hear the substance of what you say from both my colleagues and from my legislative aide. And I want to thank every one of you for taking the time to turn out today. Nothing would make me happier than to finish, but I'm already late for the next meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you, Rep. Geller. And let me just follow up on that. I know that 2 minutes is not a lot of time, but many of us, if not all of us, welcome you to come to our offices in Tallahassee and meet with us personally, or to meet with our aides if you don't feel that you've had an ample opportunity to address us today. With that, our next speaker will be Sylvia Meyer. Or you can contact us in our district offices as well if you can't make it up to Tallahassee. Following Ms. Meyer will be Melissa Faso.
Hi, good evening, and 2 minutes is more than enough time for me. I'm a nervous public speaker. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to address you. My name is Sylvia Meyer, and my family and I are longtime Hollywood residents, deeply invested in the well-being of our communities. I've been following Broward's efforts to address its accumulating waste management issues. Due to contamination and overwhelming amounts of recyclables, it's becoming more expensive to sort, clean, and properly recycle materials. The rising costs of waste management is an increasing burden to our local communities and our residents. Landfill space is quickly running out, and we are resorting to toxic incineration. Plastics are the most serious problem. They are made from fossil fuels, and production, distribution, and disposal of plastics adds to our greenhouse gas emissions. Plastic production is growing exponentially. Plastic waste ends up in landfills or worse in our streets and waterways. As Ms. Krebs pointed out, affecting our wildlife and marine life. Plastic waste recycling sorting machines are repeatedly shut down as individuals must remove plastic bags by hand. They are mixed unintentionally by well-intentioned residents who are unaware that they shouldn't be included in their recycling bins. Only 8 to 10% of plastics end up recycled. We cannot recycle our way out of the plastic problem. I urge you to support SB 320 HB 6063 to return home rule to our cities, which will repeal the onerous state law that ties the hands of local government to regulate plastics. We need the ability to limit single-use plastics in our communities. There are affordable and reliable alternative options. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming out. Yes, of course. Senator Jones has a family. If you want to just stay at the podium.
To answer this question, is for you and Ms. Krebs. Do you all have any beach cleanups or things that are happening? I mean, I know the legislation, but any other proactive things that the delegation can participate in that you can send to us?
I don't personally, but I will, when they come up, as they come up, I will certainly notify you.
Okay. I can say that there's
Surfrider
does, and then there's one that was
Surfrider. I mean, in a lot of, like, I know in Hollywood, we have a lot of volunteer organizations that organize it, and separate ones ourselves.
You see, okay.
The Better Days
Foundation is doing one in December. I think they're trying to do 100 miles of beach cleanup all at the same time.
Okay.
And I know that many of the cities and legislators have already been in touch. I just texted him to get the exact date. He did address us 2 delegation meetings ago, but he did it by phone, so I think some of what he brought to our attention was lost because he wasn't physically in front of us as you are, and it's much more powerful and impactful when you come and address us in person. So I appreciate that. Obviously, you've gotten the interest of our senators, and they represent a large majority of Broward County. I'll get them that information so that we can help keep the plastics. Yes?
I can add to that.
Sure.
I do not organize any beach cleanups. I'm just a volunteer. I'm just the lady who cleans the possum cages. What I will say about beach cleanups is beach cleanups are nice, legislation is better.
Yeah. You're preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
But we will do what we can to help you.
An off-tune choir.
Yes. thank you all. So next, Melissa Faso, and then following that is Julie Long.
Melissa Faso is not here.
Melissa Faso was not here last time. We're going to move to Julie Long. It's Ms. Long here, also, I think, addressing us about the environment.
Thank you, Representative Gottlieb and the committee. I appreciate the privilege of speaking. I'm again going to talk about the environment and plastics. I've lived in Florida most of my life. I've been a practicing pediatric surgeon in this community for almost 30 years. In my career and in my time here, I've seen the effects of environmental degradation. It doesn't spread uniformly across the population, though. It affects children, it affects people at extremes of ages, and it affects our minority communities and people with low income. I also want to speak about plastic. I agree with Ms. Kelb's comments and Sylvia Myers, the plastic problem. Beach cleanups are wonderful. It mobilizes the population and may increase awareness. The problem is we're all eating the equivalent of a credit card a week. Plastic has now been found in the placenta of babies. We're breathing it. It's in our brains. The nanoparticles are getting into our brains. We don't necessarily know the health consequences of this. I agree with all the efforts to repeal the preemption laws and also the clean energy bills that are being proposed, Senate Bill 366 and House Bill 81. I think I'm asking people that already support these efforts, but I know you have a very hard job to do, and I know there's a lot of momentum, but individuals can't fix the problems in our environment. No matter how much we care and how much we clean up beaches and bring our plastic bags, it has to be people in power. And representing people who care about their health and their environment. And I thank you for what you do.
Thank you so much. And I agree with that. I just bought some new shirts. I couldn't believe the amount of waste that goes into packaging a dress shirt in terms of the pins, the plastics around the collars. It's really...
It doesn't go away.
No, it's a shame. So I think we all share the same concern, but the fight in Tallahassee, especially as it relates to preemption, is extremely difficult. So the beach cleanups help, every little bit helps.
It makes people... gives community spirit and makes people 100%. Care.
And grassroots is really the spirit of American patriotism,
yes.
To be perfectly honest. And it's what helps spread that mission to other people who aren't aware of the great need that we have. So I think we join you in your fight. Don't be deterred.
The problem is it's our children. It's our unborn children that are getting plastic into their bodies. It's going into our brains through nanoparticles. It's going to take a long time for science to prove how toxic our environment is to us.
Appreciate that, Doctor. Thank you.
I appreciate your work.
Thank you so much. Susan Caruso, Broward Sierra Group. That will end the theme of our environmental pioneers.
Hi, good evening. My name is Sue Caruso. I'm here tonight as a 40-plus year resident of Broward County, a wife and mom of three adult children, grandmom of five grandchildren, retired teacher, and a Broward Sierra Conservation Chair. Our three legislative priorities this year, no surprise, climate change, land conservation, and water quality and quantity, and I'd like to address the first two. Legislation that solely funds climate resiliency without funding climate change reduction is like bailing out a boat with a hole in it. It's only going to get harder and harder to keep it afloat. So please use your power to fund climate change reduction by, one, setting bold goals for clean energy that will make a difference. I know there's a bill out there to preempt the local ability to do that, but please support co-sponsor Senate Bill 366 and House Bill 81 to that end. Secondly, protect and restore natural ecosystems that sequester carbon and provide invaluable services such as filtering, cleaning our air and water. To that end, please fully fund Florida Forever. It's about time we do that. Again, reducing the plastics that require more fossil fuels to be mined and processed, that release greenhouse gases as they decay and become those ubiquitous little microplastics that are dangerous to human health and wildlife. And please do that by supporting, co-sponsoring, and voting for Senate Bill 320 and House Bill 6063. And please, please, no more preemptions. The state senator or state legislators that complain about the feds coming down and trying their hands have no problem turning around and doing the same thing to local governments. We need to get rid of that.
So first of all, I want to thank you so much. I consider this kind of event democracy in action, and that's so threatened right now. So thank you so much for being here and paying attention. I do appreciate that as a teacher, especially. And
we also know we're being graded.
Yeah, you know it, you know it. So thank you so much, and please keep fighting the good fight. Thank you.
Something else I just want to say is that a couple of us spoke, and we are trying to do, it'll be for our delegation, but just so you all know that your voices are being heard, we are trying to put together in December, hopefully, an environmental lunch and learn for our delegation, so that not that we don't understand the issues, but the more information that we are taught, the better off we will be in Tallahassee as we try to advance your legislative concerns. So
we can certainly help you with valid sources if you are, who are you getting the information from makes a difference too. So anything the Broward Sierra group can do, please call on us.
We'll make sure to invite you.
Awesome.
As well.
Say hi to
Coach
Caruso.
Yes,
Ms. Okay. All right, with that, thank you so much. We've got two speakers in a row from SEIU.
Woo! A lot of takes in the house.
And, you can have the whole union come and stand behind him. I mean, there are strength in numbers.
We got some purple here today.
Good evening, everyone. Chair, Vice Chair, delegation. Thanks for having us again. I'm here specifically to talk about Senate Bill 804, which was just filed not too long ago, a few days ago. And so for more than 20 years, the state's legislature has been chipping away at nursing home staffing requirements previously put in place to ensure quality care for elderly, vulnerable Floridians. But with the law that passed early this year, a new proposed bill for the upcoming legislative session, these folks have launched a striking, more brazen, and dangerous attack on seniors and their caregivers across the state, caregivers like the ones behind me. This effort is in a conjunction with the multi-billion dollar nursing home industry and their lobbyists who wish to maximize profit instead of proper staffing and other safeguards for nursing home residents and staff. Their core strategy is to avoid, eliminate minimum requirements of direct care by CNAs, who have served as the backbone of quality long-term care in our state. CNAs handle the bulk of essential daily needs, as you guys know, feeding, bathing, dressing, taking vital signs, and so much more. And of course, those are our parents, grandparents that they're taking care of. The recently passed legislation, what we call PCA law, allows for lesser trained and lower paid PCAs to carry out tasks previously reserved for more highly trained CNAs and have that care count toward the CNA minimums. But the newest proposed legislation, Senate Bill 804, is more dangerous and extreme. It is literally taking nursing out of nursing homes. It slashes almost all meaningful CNA staffing requirements, essentially allowing anyone off the street with zero training to handle some of the most difficult and delicate tasks while caring for our most frail seniors. Let's not joke this, no voter across Florida should be fooled. The long-term care operators and their Tallahassee partners have been trying these same tricks to weaken our nursing home care system for more than 20 years. If we really wish to protect our seniors, we should make standards stronger, pay quality caregivers better, and elect leaders who will truly serve our elders over industry profits. Thanks for your time, and we hope to harass you more in Tallahassee.
you guys never harass us. We appreciate your advocacy. It's some of Florida's most vulnerable population. Many people come to Florida to retire here, right. and you guys are taking care of our families. And, we really, truly appreciate the work that you guys do.
Awesome.
Yeah, I want to add to that. God bless you all. I mean, we talk so much. We hear it on TV. We hear other legislators pontificate, our governor, about caring about frontline workers and caring about Floridians. Yet, year after year, the Florida legislature passes legislation that reduces staffing levels, makes it harder for you all to do your jobs, promotes a substandard class of worker instead of the skilled nursing care and home health care that you all provide. It's just outrageous. There's no other way to describe it. These are our most frail, vulnerable citizens of this state. Thank you for all you do. Keep doing it, please. I know you got bruises on your forehead from banging against that wall year after year after year. But please keep going and keep doing what you're doing. We suffered last year so much from having the Capitol closed down.
Right.
and not having that in-person advocacy. And seeing you all here in force and sharing real life stories of what you deal with on a day in and day out basis is just so important. Democracy thrives on participation and it dies with antipathy. And just thank you for what you do. Keep doing it, please. Thank you,
Senator. My condolences to you, Senator.
Thank you.
And any addressing us at all?
Yes, Penny will be talking about the, believe it or not, there's a crisis in the hospitals as well.
And unions are very
And unions are.
Good evening. My name is Penny Caesar, and I work at Westside Regional Medical Center, which is a hospital near here. Myself and all members of our organization are desperately calling for wage equity and other measures to improve staffing levels and patient care at our area hospitals as the public health emergency continues to rage. Experienced healthcare givers are worn down from serving on the front lines of the historic health crisis that has overrun hospitals and led to the death of more than 55,000 Floridians. So many are departing in unprecedented numbers, which puts even greater pressure on those who remain to provide high quality health care. The most experienced and talented caregivers, many of whom contracted COVID-19 at some point during the pandemic, are leaving the profession. And the highest number due to the physical and mental stress of long shifts and weeks. Many are leaving because of lower pay scales. That new employees and substantially less than temporary agency CNAs are traveler nurses who facilities contract in an attempt to close staffing shortages. New hires signing bonuses and agents contracts can be three times greater than the hourly salary of full-time workers like myself. But they don't want to make the Hospitals make billions of dollars in profits, and much of their revenues come from tax dollars. But they don't want to make the commitment to pay their full-time workers what we deserve. This is not fair and creates a serious challenge for the quality, the area overall healthcare system. Thank you for your time and allowing me to speak today. Yes, I notice in the hospitals, we have so many new people coming in because all of our seasoned employees are leaving because they have someone next to them making three times what they make after being committed to that particular hospital. Someone comes in new, makes more than them. And we're having one-year nurses train new nurses. So it's cutting down on the quality of care that we are able to give. So we need your help with supporting us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again. We appreciate the work you guys do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay, Lucy Morales, Coles, Mark's manager. And after Ms. Rouse, we'll have Dr. Michael McKenzie and then Peyton Pipes.
Good evening. My name is Lucy Rolls, and I'm a volunteer with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. We are very grateful for the support that you've given us in the past, and we are looking forward to working with you in the upcoming session. We do have a few priorities that I'd like to mention specifically. First, we are expecting to see a bill filed by Senator Bracey soon, one that would create an Office of Community Violence Intervention and Prevention. This office's role would be to better fund and provide technical assistance and capacity building to community violence intervention programs. Community Violence Intervention and Prevention Programs, or CVIPs, are community-based efforts that work to either interrupt the cycle of violence or address its root causes. Some examples of these programs are street outreach, violence reduction through environmental design, safe passage programs, and youth employment and education programs. Here in Broward County, Chainless Change is an organization that offers programs and services that promote self-sufficiency and public safety to those negatively impacted by the criminal justice system. This is exactly the type of program that this office could support. This is a bill and program that we really believe in, and we hope we have your support. A second priority we hope will be addressed this session is the repeal of Stand Your Ground, and we appreciate old Senator Jones's hard work on this issue. We've seen that Stand Your Ground laws encourage avoidable escalation of violence, and they do not deter crime. This is an issue that not only affects the safety of everyday Floridians, but our law enforcement as well. Just last year, a man successfully used Stand Your Ground defense after he shot and almost killed Brevard County Sheriff's Deputy Casey Smith. Your support on this will be vital. We also hope that you all stand in opposition to HB 103, Representative Sabatini's bill to allow permitless carry. Doing away this licensure requirements for concealed carry permits is a recipe for increased gun violence, as we've already seen in states that have implemented it, like Missouri, Texas, and Tennessee. This is not an idea that we would want to take hold in Florida. Finally, thank you all for the bills that you have introduced this session with the goal of reducing gun violence. We're following them all closely, and we look forward to supporting them as they move through the committee. Thank you for your representation of all people in Broward County, and thank you for your support on these issues.
Thank you for coming here. I can tell you, I've worked with Mark Mitchell personally in Chainless Change, and they do a great job, and I appreciate you guys collaborating with them. Thank you for everything that you do. I wouldn't be so concerned about House Bill 103. I don't think it's going any place. For those of us who do have like that red flag bill, I know Senator Polsky does, Brett Lachowski, Brett Daly, and I can speak for the rest of my members over here. You know, we all do what we can to support you.
And we appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And the sad thing is, not one of those bills will get a hearing. I filed 5 gun safety pieces of legislation this year. I've done so for all my years in the Senate, and not once have we had even a single hearing. Why do they fear the debate? Don't get it.
Because they know they're probably lose.
It was a rhetorical question, but thanks for coming. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. McKenzie. Dr. Michael McKenzie is not present. I'm going to discuss medical cannabis. Do we have Peyton Pipes? Peyton Pipes, I think, also on medical marijuana. So with that being said, I do want to thank my delegation. We don't get extra pay for being here. There's no fame for us to be here. Many of us have been here since 2:30, believe it or not, working on delegation matters, and it's a long day. I know you all think that we don't hear your concerns, but we do, and we fight vigilantly for you. And some of us have done that, I think, for 18 years, right, Evan? With that being said, the legislation special session will be held November 15th to 17th. Many of you, I'm sure, know that. Remaining upcoming interim committee meets in Tallahassee on November 15th and 19th and November 23rd, 29th to December 3rd. The legislative session begins Tuesday, January 11th. I want to finish my close by again thanking JAFCO for this wonderful, beautiful facility. This room, by the way, is for rent for bar mitzvahs, weddings, or any other happy occasion you wish to use JAFCO for. I want to thank Ms. Wilson and Ms. Knowles, and of course our delegation counsel, Mr. Weinstein. All legislative meetings are available to be viewed on the Florida Channel at https://thefloridachannel.org. Thank you all for coming and attending. We truly appreciate your support. Oh, Broward Days. Broward Days is in Tallahassee. Broward Days, if you don't know about Broward Days and you want to come up and you really want to address us, I suggest That's how I got involved, believe it or not, in this system. I came up to Broward Days, I loved it, and I ran for the legislature and won. So you could be the next person sitting up here if you attend Broward Days. Broward Days is in January 18th and 19th. It's an opportunity to come up to the legislature in Tallahassee with other like-minded individuals from Broward. We plan a whole host of events, fun activities. You get to meet a lot of legislators from both sides. Typically, we get the Speaker of the House, maybe the President of the Senate, to address Broward Days, so you really get to hear from people at the top and question them about why your concerns perhaps are not being heard. Details for registration, hotels, and sponsorship are all available at www.browarddays.com. Join us in Tallahassee. With that, thank you, and good night.